as some cities and states look to decriminalize marijuana, should Jacksonville do the same? Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead this Monday, a look at new legislation that aims to decriminalize possession of small amounts of cannabis in the city. What do you think about that? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, how Baptist Health plans to help patients recover faster after surgery. Plus, don't miss the live in studio performance from the Sandalwood High School Marching Band. Find out what they're up to. All of that ahead. But first this hour, Jacksonville City Councilman Garrett Dennis has introduced legislation to decriminalize the possession of small amounts of marijuana. Now, if it passes, Dennis's bill would add Jacksonville to a growing list of states and cities moving to eliminate criminal penalties for recreational use of the drug. It wouldn't legalize marijuana, but it would decriminalize possession of marijuana. There's a difference. So can this measure succeed or will it go up in smoke? Couldn't resist saying that. Jacksonville City Councilman Garrett Dennis joins us now with more about this push for pot. Good morning, Garrett Dennis. Good to see you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me this morning.
And here's our question to callers. What do you think of the push to decriminalize small amounts of marijuana possession in the city of Jacksonville? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Or weigh in on our Facebook page. All right. So, Councilman, you filed legislation to decriminalize small amounts of marijuana. This bill filed last week. This would allow police to issue a civil citation if you're caught with less than 20 grams of marijuana or paraphernalia, rather than arrest and prosecute them. Already, the mayor's office and the sheriff's office have pushed back on your measure, saying that they are not really in support of this. Why did you decide to file this bill?
I think now is the time. I mean, you know, as I was out campaigning and talking to constituents, I hear countless stories of family and lives being turned upside down for being arrested for small amounts of marijuana. Matter of fact, last week I received a call from a gentleman. He was telling me about his son was pulled over and had a small, as a roach, you know, it's called on the street, a roach that was
a roach clip.
A roach clip. A roach.
Yeah, like a little piece of
marijuana.
Yeah, sure.
And he had smoked it a few days earlier, and he was pulled over, thrown in jail. They had to go out and get an attorney to fight the charges. Eventually, the charges were dropped, but that family was turned into turmoil financially because of that. In talking to people, even talking to law enforcement, you know, someone's arrested, they have a job, they can't get a bond, they're in jail for several days. We're housing them, that we're feeding them, and so it's an economic as well as a moral issue here.
You're saying that this would free police up to focus on more serious crimes. You don't believe locking up a low-level offender is smart justice. Now, under the current law, possession of a small amount of cannabis is a first-degree misdemeanor. It's punishable by up to a year in jail and a $1,000 fine. Your proposal would replace that with a $100 fine or 10 hours of community service. Have you modeled that on what other cities have done?
Yes. This particular bill is modeled from Palm Beach County. It's being done in South Beach, Miami Beach, Hillsborough County, right to the south of us, Volusia County. And so, we're not pioneers. We're just following the trend throughout the state. And again, small amounts of marijuana, you shouldn't be thrown in jail. I mean, again, decriminalization is basically going from a criminal infraction to a civil infraction.
And lots of calls already for Garrett Dennis. The city councilman has introduced a bill that would decriminalize marijuana possession in Jacksonville, a small amount of it. It's 549-2937, and we'll go to your calls in a moment. Now, of course, in 2016, Florida voters approved a constitutional amendment that legalizes medical marijuana. Recreational use is still illegal officially, although, as you've pointed out, cities and counties around Florida are loosening up these penalties. What would you say to those opposing your bill who see this as a slippery slope to full legalization and they don't support that?
Again, my bill is basically how it's still an infraction. It's still illegal. And in no way is this bill trying to change that. It's just how we deal with the infraction. Do you think someone should be thrown in jail, go before a judge, you know, all those, all the legal, get into the court system, or should they receive a, a citation? And I fall on the side of a citation for a small amount of marijuana. I mean, think about it. And I was thinking about the thing about this, this weekend, the district that I represent has more call-ins for opioids and overdose than any other district in the city. When the police and fire department pull up to someone that's overdosed or potential overdose, and there are extra pills there that they've overdosed, they're not hauled off to jail. They're sent to a treatment facility. However, if someone with small amount of marijuana, they're caught with it, they're thrown in jail, and now they're in the court system. Now they have a record. Now they're going to lose their jobs and things like that. Why not give them a citation?
Okay. And let me ask you about the politics of this. You are seen by many local political observers as the strongest voice of opposition on the Jacksonville City Council to Mayor Curry and his allies on the city council.
Sure.
So is this just a symbolic move by you? What are the real chances of getting the votes you need on the city council for passage, given that the mayor will do everything in his power to deny you that legislative victory? He'll encourage his supporters on the council to vote against this.
Well, if any of my colleagues vote against this because the mayor doesn't want it, shame on them. This isn't about the mayor. This is about a moral issue. This is about a larger issue. You know, it's, you know, for those fiscally conservative colleagues, I mean, think how much we're spending when we're throwing someone in jail for one joint, you know, or a small marijuana. Think how much money is coming out of our, you know, out of our coffers. And then there's conversation to build a brand new jail. I mean, are we going to build a 4,000 house jail or 5,000 occupancy jail, you know, to throw more of marijuana users in jail? So, you know, I hope my colleagues vote on this bill on the merits and not because one person, you know, wants it dead.
And of course, laws vary from state to state. But here are the facts right now. 15 states around the country have decriminalized marijuana, even if they haven't fully legalized it. What do you think of the bill that would decriminalize marijuana in Jacksonville? 549-2937. Lots of calls on this very hot topic this morning. Travis is in Mandarin. Hey, Travis. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning.
Go ahead, Travis.
Bakers, thank you for taking my call. My comment first is that it's well known that marijuana disproportionately impacts, or marijuana crimes disproportionately impact minority communities and people of color. And so I think this measure is a fantastic way to help us free up resources for JSO to actually combat crimes that are major and that are impacting those communities. But my question for the councilman, this also would free up a lot of taxpayer dollars that are now being placed, the burden is being placed on taxpayers in the criminal justice system. How would this, or do you have numbers and dollars that would equate tangibly to how this would free up taxpayer burden as well?
Thanks for that question. Councilman Dennis.
Yeah, so I've had conversations with the sheriff, and right now he shared with me that he will have me numbers within the next week or so. But they're huge. I mean, think about it. You know, the last report I saw there in 2018, there's over 800 arrests for small possessions of marijuana, over 800. So think about 800 people in the jails that we're paying for, you know, corrections, you know, time in the court system. So it's huge, and so we'll have those numbers within the next week or so, and it's a drain on our you know, on our revenue.
Robert is in Atlantic Beach. Hey, Robert, happy Monday to you. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Good morning. I used to provide technical surveillance capability and technical surveillance countermeasures capability to the National Narcotics Border Interdiction System. So I'm coming at this from a law enforcement perspective. I have believed since the late 80s that if we decriminalize small amounts of marijuana, we will do several things. Most importantly, we will shut down the ability of gangs to create more criminal activity by taking away a funding mechanism. Secondly, most of the people that go to jail for a small amount of marijuana cost us money and don't do anything for society. So I support this measure. Even as a former federal law enforcement officer, I support this measure. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Robert. And that's honestly, the majority of Americans are where Robert is now. Sizable majorities of Americans, and it's bipartisan, support either full or partial marijuana legalization, although people might fall on a spectrum of how far they want to go with this, Councilman Dennis. Sure. And so, I mean, certainly this has a lot of popular appeal. At the same time, someone asked you about the numbers you're getting from the sheriff. Here's a tweet from Jimmy. Why didn't the councilman speak to law enforcement for buy-in? Why not hold public meetings or meet with his colleagues about this? I support the bill, but the process so far isn't helping to build consensus. Are you all alone on this?
I'm not. You know, there's been a conversation with law enforcement prior to the bill and since the bill has been out. So I'm not working in a silo. And yes, within the next few weeks, I will be having community meetings. There will be notice meetings, you know, with various colleagues. So it's not a long ranger. It's definitely going to be a community-wide effort as we move forward, because this will be a new shift, a new place for our city.
And it's really interesting to get all of these calls from all over the listening area this morning. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about Councilman Garrett Dennis's bill that would decriminalize small amounts of marijuana in the city of Jacksonville. What do you think about that? It's 549-2937. Tom is on the west side. Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I'm wonderful. How about yourself?
Really good, thanks.
Outstanding. Just wanted to say, as they said in the Prohibition era, any law that turns such a large amount of its population into criminals cannot be just. And same thing today.
So you see this as not unlike the Prohibition era in the way we treat marijuana. You see this as similar to alcohol prohibition?
Oh, I think it's almost exactly analogous.
Hmm. Okay. Thanks, Tom. What about that?
Okay.
Again, you know, I'm not for marijuana. I don't smoke marijuana, you know. But again, it's how we deal with these infractions. It is illegal, but I don't think that someone should be thrown in jail for a small amount of marijuana for a joint or two. I think if someone is caught with it, I truly believe that a citation should be given. You know, also my bill, you know, this money's going into a trust fund. Maybe we could have, classes and things that these individuals take. But I do not think someone should get a record and be in the judicial system because a small amount of marijuana. So this bill is about how we deal with those infractions. It is still illegal. It's just how we deal with it.
By the way, just last week, a man was arrested at Jacksonville International Airport for carrying with him 50 pounds of marijuana.
And he should be in jail.
They were right inside his suitcase. Obvious, all he had to do was open it up and see them. You are talking about small amounts.
Right.
So let's be clear on that. And also, when you look at the effectiveness of civil citations for marijuana, are they effective? Do they work?
I think so. I mean, again, you know, this is modeled after other counties and cities throughout the state. And if you look at the counties and cities, we're the last major city that has not taken action. And so this,
you mentioned South Florida. What about Orlando and Tampa?
Orlando, Tampa, Hillsborough County, Orlando, Volusia County to the south.
They've all decriminalized.
They've all decriminalized.
So Jacksonville is standing alone in terms of large Florida cities. Here is an email from a listener. This is obviously the direction in which things are moving. However, since Jacksonville will remain a backwater town until we elect a more progressive mayor, it stands no chance of becoming reality. Are we a backwater? Is this city a backwater?
I think there are some people in our city, and you can throw the mayor in there, that want to keep the status quo, and want to continue to put as many people in jail to say they're tough on crime, when it's not being productive for our society. I love Jacksonville. This is a place that I decided to come back after college. So I don't see Jacksonville as backwater city, but I do think there are some people that don't think big. They think small. And so I hope 9 of my colleagues will think big and support this bill when it comes before the floor.
You need 10 out of 19 votes. Will it even get to the floor, though? Is it even going to get that far?
Well, there may be some procedural to not even have it heard, but the voices of the people need to be heard. They need to call their council members. They need to come down to council. They need to talk about it. And when we start having these community meetings to discuss it, they need to come out and say, this is what we want, not what, one person, the mayor, wants.
Now, let me ask you another question, Councilman Dennis. Are you filing these kinds of high-profile, splashy bills to position yourself to run for mayor yourself in a few years?
No, this is the right thing to do. It has nothing to do about politics. It has nothing to do about positioning myself for the future. It's the right thing to do. And every bill that I file, it's about bettering the quality of life for the citizens here in Jacksonville.
Lots of calls, meanwhile, on the push to decriminalize marijuana in Jacksonville. James is at the beaches. Hey, James. Good morning, James. You're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to make a quick point. I see the mayor and the sheriff actually all the time. They work out at the YMCA with me, and I voted for them. I'm a Democrat, but I voted for them to give them a chance. If I knew they wouldn't support things like this, I wouldn't give them that chance. They're on the wrong side of history. I'm a medical marijuana patient who can't afford my medicine. I have to grow it. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm starting to tear up. And it's too much stress to have to not be able to afford something from Trulieve and such, have to grow it myself, and have to worry about going to prison for it. It's ridiculous. I suffer with PTSD. I serve my country, and I deserve respect.
Yeah, James, and I'm sorry you're struggling. Hey, let me ask you, Florida's in a really interesting sort of gray area when it comes to THC. Officially, cannabis is still illegal, although it's legal for medical use. Do you try other ways of getting the compound, like CBD oil, which you can really buy anywhere now, to help with your anxiety?
I find the CBD doesn't, for me, work as much by itself. In conjunction, my biggest issue personally is the not being able to grow it. I can't afford going to Trulieve and all these places. It's too expensive. $50 for an eighth of marijuana or for these oil cartridges they sell.
Right.
How the medical marijuana law was set up, it was to support these big corporations other than allowing poor people to be able to grow something that's as easy as growing tomatoes. It's ridiculous.
All right, James, thanks for calling in. And, he's getting at the other part of this discussion, Councilman Dennis, which is that hundreds of thousands of Floridians voted for access to medical marijuana in 2016 because they have a whole variety of conditions that cannabis helps.
Right.
Your bill, it doesn't get at that, but
it's
certainly of interest to a lot of people out there.
Yeah. It's how we handle the infraction. If someone is caught with a small amount of marijuana, do we throw them in jail or do we just give them a ticket and fine them for it?
And as he pointed out, even when you want to use it legally for medical purposes, it's unaffordable still for a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's still too expensive, although that could change as the market expands, hopefully for the people that need it. Let's go to Brandy on the South Side. Hi, Brandy. How are you? Good morning.
Good morning. I fully support this bill. My question is, how would it affect people that are already incarcerated for small amounts of marijuana? And I'll take my response off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that question.
Yeah, unfortunately, this bill doesn't go back and correct those wrongs. It's moving forward. You just don't know how many people I've talked to since filing this bill and that question has come up. And unfortunately, there's no way to retro or go back. Now we're just gonna have to move forward and I think we're all on the same page that it's time to decriminalize and not throw individuals in jail for small amounts of marijuana.
Lots of tweets. Tara tweets the show, every person we keep out of jail who is not a risk to public safety saves taxpayer money and lowers crime. Many who go to jail become better criminals for their experience because we don't pay for education and programs for inmates. Here's another tweet. Marijuana crimes disproportionately impact minority communities and people of color, which leads to numerous other economic and societal inequalities. Decriminalization will not only help relieve the taxpayer burden in the criminal justice system, but reduce racial inequities. Okay, what about that part of this?
Oh, it's huge. It's huge. It's huge. And I'm looking forward to those numbers from the sheriff's office. And I think it's spot on. I mean, those are our assumptions that, that minorities are disproportionately arrested and thrown into the judicial system because of marijuana. And I think the numbers will show that. And, when I first filed this bill, it had nothing to do, on a racial scale, but you'll see that the scale is tipped, toward minorities more so than white citizens here in Jacksonville.
Because the fines are out of reach for more people of color and,
it can also be used as a profiling mechanism for police officers to arrest African-American and minority users once they're in the system. It's probably harder for them to get bail. You know, our bail system scale is very expensive. So there's a lot of other factors once someone is arrested with marijuana.
We'll go back to some more of your calls for City Councilman Garrett Dennis in a moment. It's 549-2937 to join us as we talk about the push to decriminalize marijuana in Jacksonville, possession of small amounts. You'd get a civil citation rather than an arrest record. And prosecution. What do you think about this as other cities have experimented with these laws? Lots of comments coming in on Twitter and Facebook. Here's one on our Facebook page from Vic. Criminal laws against recreational marijuana use are state laws, aren't they? How does a city get involved? Can you explain why some cities are increasingly going their own way on this issue, drafting their own ordinances that may or may not go in accordance with the state law?
So the state law says it gives a maximum, a ceiling, that if someone is caught, the maximum is a year in jail or $1,000 fine. So a city cannot pass a law that supersedes that goes beyond that. A city has the discretion with home rule to pass any laws less than that. And so So that's how cities and counties are able to do that. And that's the reason why I filed this bill to decriminalize, instead of, being an arrest option, to be a civil citation. And look, I mean, just last week and the day I filed the bill, the sheriff, the state attorney, the public defender, they were having a committee on trying to increase more civil citations here in our city and not send more of our citizens into the criminal justice system. This is one other thing we should add to their list of things for civil citations. So again, we have home rule and we're able to do it because it's less than what the state has mandated.
A few more tweets coming into the show. Chad tweets the show. This isn't a Republican or Democratic issue. The economics alone dictate a civil citation. Now, how about this? Just this morning, the governor of North Dakota signed a bill into law making North Dakota the 25th state in the nation to eliminate the threat of jail time for possession of small amounts of marijuana. North Dakota.
Is that a Republican governor or a Democratic governor?
I'm pretty sure it's a Republican governor.
He needs to call the mayor.
And so, it's interesting to note this because increasingly there is bipartisan consensus around this issue.
Absolutely.
And it's one of the few issues in our polarized political time that we're living through that people tend to agree on for the most part. And so it's striking to note that though we have bipartisan consensus all around the country, you are getting pushback from both the mayor and the sheriff.
Both are Republicans, both are political allies. Both their campaigns been ran by one person or their.
Are they pushing back on you just because they don't like you? You've been a thorn in their side. You've opposed them. You've spoken out against them. They don't want to give you a win on anything. Is that what's going on?
It's a moral issue, but it's much bigger than Councilman Garrett Dennis, it's our city. And so if they're so petty to influence my colleagues, my other 18 colleagues, because of their vendetta or their issues with me, it's wrong. It's wrong. And so they're going to continue to keep Jacksonville in the backwoods. They're going to continue to, you know, to have Jacksonville be called that, you know, that backwoods Calvert city. But regardless of how they feel, I mean, it's the right thing to do. Like you said, it's bipartisan support all over town. It's wrong to throw someone in jail for small amounts of marijuana when we have other tools in the toolbox, such as civil citations to penalize those infractions.
What would you say to those who agree with you on the merits, but they think you could work better with other stakeholders in this space here?
And they'll see that. They'll see, you know, there'll be, again, public meetings, community meetings throughout the city, notice meetings with my colleagues before the vote. So this is something that we'll have to vote on in the next few weeks. This is something that will, you know, that will cautiously move forward.
Lane tweets the show, why even give a citation? If it's a small amount for personal use, why do anything at all? She says, 549-2937. Melody is in St. Augustine. Hey, Melody, good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to make a comment. I think the general public needs to be more informed about what happened in the 1950s with the demonization of the plant cannabis. Actually, marijuana, that name tag was created. And ever since then, it's big pharmaceuticals demonizing the great properties that come out of this cannabis plant. Human beings actually have endocannabinoid system in their body that has receptors that attach to the cannabinoids in the plant that can heal from within. And all you have to do is go on YouTube, watch the Sacred Plant series. It tells you what's happened to the demonization of marijuana, how it's become a feared gateway drug, so to speak. And, you know, they just need to be informed and realize that this plant can heal people. And your earlier caller that you had, I mean, it's expensive. I've on CBD oil, which is not helping me. I have multiple issues.
Why isn't it helping you, Melody? Why isn't it helping you?
I guess it's just not helping me because I need the THC.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, you know, to go to the clinic here, we have a clinic here that's that has, you know, seminars and help groups, but it's like the first consultation is $250. Insurance doesn't cover it. And then he's right about even purchasing something which has the THC. Of course, it's got to be a licensed medical doctor, but insurance doesn't cover any of that. And, you know, you're like, I can grow it, I can juice it, it'll help me then. But, you know, it's not legal. So what do you do?
Right.
You know?
And what do you need it for? What do you need it for?
Well, I'd rather not discuss my condition.
Okay. That's fine. But I understand your point of view, yeah. And I appreciate you calling, Melody. That's Melody in St. Augustine. Thanks for all of that, Melody. And
called the Sacred Plant.
Yeah, thank you for that. Okay. And as she pointed out, Councilman, Americans have really come around to appreciating the health benefits for a variety of conditions that THC can provide. And the reefer madness era in America, in terms of our drug enforcement strategy, that is on the wane.
Right.
And so you are well within the mainstream of other cities in making this push. And so what are the next steps for this bill?
The next steps, planning community meetings throughout the city, engaging my colleagues in notice meetings. And so we'll be moving quickly for that. Tomorrow, it'll actually be introduced at council meeting tomorrow. And so it'll go through the legislative process. And so that will be the next steps. And I just encourage the citizens of Jacksonville just to call their council members to let them know how they feel about this bill and this issue, because again, one person probably, you know, can, you know, the mayor's office and sheriff's office probably can try to influence the other 18 council members, but the people who has the power are the citizens of the city. And so, you know, I just encourage them to make calls and to come out to the community meetings and share their concerns.
City Councilman Garrett Dennis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Much more still ahead later on the show. Cole Pepper with the latest on the Jaguars. Plus, don't miss it as we enjoy a live in studio performance from the Sandalwood High School Marching Band. Find out what they're up to and how you can help them win a pretty unique competition. But up next, recovering faster after surgery. New protocols from Baptist Health. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Back in a moment.
Sight and Sound Productions. If your job is to make the boss in your company look good and sound amazing on stage, we're here to stay up all night so you don't have to. Sight and Sound Productions. Audio, video, lighting, and peace of mind. SSAV.net.
UF Health North on Max Leggett Parkway is the region's newest hospital and outpatient medical center, featuring all private rooms, 12 labor and delivery suites, full imaging, surgical services, and 24-hour emergency care. More at north.ufhealthjax.org.
Cypress Village, a continuing care retirement community, features resort lifestyle amenities which allow residents to remain active and vibrant. The new alternative to long-term care insurance. 901-4004. More at lifecare.brookdale.com.
From the roots of jazz with Louis Armstrong and Miles Davis to contemporary artists like Melody Gardot and Eric Truffaz, 89.9 HD4 plays nonstop jazz 24/7 for the month of May.
Welcome back. Well, healthcare providers are starting to embrace an innovative new set of protocols designed to help patients heal faster after a surgery. Now, this is known as ERAS, or Enhanced Recovery After Surgery. And Baptist Health is leading the way on this. Here with more, Josue Brainin, MD, anesthesiologist at Baptist Health. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Francine Mirabel is here. She's Director of Safety and Clinical Quality and leader of the ERAS Multidisciplinary Task Force for Baptist Health. That is a mouthful. Good morning, Francine.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Okay, Francine, let's begin with you now. For years, patients were told to fast the night before surgery, nothing to eat or drink. That was one way to prepare for surgery. That's changing, though. Tell me a little bit about what this means. What is ERAS, Enhanced Recovery After Surgery?
Certainly is a mouthful, correct?
Yeah.
Enhanced recovery, really in its essence, is a patient-centered approach to their surgical experience. It really starts with the patient first learning that they're needing surgery, they're thinking about it, all the way through the surgical procedure, and most importantly, the recovery phase,
mm-hmm.
And helping our patients focus on a few key areas all the way through.
What are those key areas?
We look at keeping them hydrated, as you know, you would typically in your daily activities, staying hydrated leading up to surgery, increasing your activity so you have a little more walking, a little more preparation, preparing your lungs and your body, really in the effort of reducing the stress leading into surgery. And your nutritional status as well, making sure you're staying healthy, high protein diet, all leading up with surrounding our patients with care.
Just to reduce the trauma associated with surgery, Dr. Brainin, as an anesthesiologist, you want to make sure that the patient wakes up after the surgery. How do these new protocols help patients get through this a little easier?
Well, it starts with their preparation before surgery, as Francine said. And so it's having patients that are hydrated show up to the operating room rather than being starved. There's less stress and it's easier for us to maintain their blood pressure and hemodynamic parameters that we're after during the procedure. we also involve what's called multimodal pain therapy. So it's not just your opioids that we use for controlling pain. There's other medicines involved that are run-of-the-mill, over-the-counter type of stuff, like a Motrin and a Tylenol, and then regional techniques that we use to reduce the amount of pain medicines that patients require.
Now, why the change? Why are you now telling patients it's okay to have water before this procedure, whereas before they weren't allowed to do that? What's driving all these changes?
It's exciting to see where the research is leading us, and it's taking us down the road of you want to prepare as if you're preparing for a race.
Like the Gay River Run, right?
Your patients are staying hydrated the night before. You're hearing about their carb loading the night before. Although we're not promoting, you know, big spaghetti dinners, in the surgical world, it's drinking a high carbohydrate drink before you come in for your surgery into the hospital. So it's exciting changes.
Has research shown that the old way of doing things wasn't necessary? Is that why you're making these changes?
Absolutely. So when it comes to when to stop drinking, patients do better if they drink up to 2 hours before surgery than if they start from the night before. And it's a couple ways that they do better. The hydration status lets us keep a more normal blood pressure. Normal blood pressure during surgery is super important. Again, the carbohydrate loading component of it also has shown to improve healing and patients' recoveries.
And are you talking about major surgery that you implement this for, or does that include outpatient surgery? What kinds of surgical procedures are you using this new protocol around?
So the protocols is for major surgeries, and we're rolling it out by service lines. But the guidelines for when to stop eating and drinking, which is drinking up to clears up to 2 hours before surgery, those apply to all surgical procedures.
Okay. This is interesting because, you know, people are scared to go under the knife, Francine. They're scared to be anesthetized. This is frightening for most people. It's traumatic. How does ERAS, enhanced recovery after surgery, reduce fear and trauma for patients?
These are things that our team has thought about now since we started looking at these protocols now for about 2 years. We started in the colorectal service line for colon surgery, and we really looked at preparing the patient, helping them understand what to expect after surgery, the amount of walking that we're asking for to increase their lung function and getting them back to being able to go back home and to recover at home. So really thinking about reducing the stress of the patient and bringing them through the surgical experience in a way that makes sense to them.
Now, you also, under this protocol, try to manage pain for patients with a limited use of opioids. Let me ask you about that, doctor, because, of course, we're in the midst of a raging opioid epidemic in Florida and nationally. How do you get patients through the aftermath and manage their pain and make sure they don't develop a dependence on opiates?
So you focus on every other component that can help. So, for example, Tylenol, Motrin, and regional techniques, as well as the gabapentinoids and other medicines that we hear about but we don't use. When all medicines are used in smaller quantities but more numbers of them, patients tend to need less of the opioids. The other component of that is that everyone needs a different amount of opioids. But as physicians, we're boxed in. We are writing a prescription that kind of hits the middle ground for people. So we're also thinking about creative ways to tailor that to every patient and then also helping them know what to do with the medicines after. It turns out that people get a hold of medicines. It's not grandma who had the hip surgery. It's maybe the plumber or the teenager that goes into the bathroom after. And so that's kind of our focus, is seeing how we can reduce the amounts that go home and then also preparing people to do the right thing with them after.
And the best thing, too, with having less opioids on board for a patient is the ability to walk after surgery and the ability to eat after surgery. The opioids tend to slow down your digestive system, so patients can eat right away, feel more comfortable and confident walking, not feel as dizzy and in a cloud. With our nursing team together walking patients, you know, we can work to get someone
feel more
home
like
a little
themselves.
Quicker. Yeah.
Well, this is working according to your statistics. You started this pilot program at Baptist Health in 2017, And you've already seen that ERAS patients for enhanced recovery after surgery, they need 21% less pain medication. They spend 2 fewer days on average in the hospital. 80% of ERAS patients are out of bed the day of surgery compared to just 20% before you started this.
And I want to showcase some other services as well in our urology service line, our thoracic service line, in partnership with MD Anderson. We've seen great success, yes.
And is this the way hospitals are going all over the country? Are you following along in research that other healthcare providers think is...
We are. We stay very connected with the current literature that's coming out and showing the results in a way that is making a difference and we can utilize in our organization, yes.
Baptist Health implementing enhanced recovery after surgery. One big change, they're eliminating fasting before midnight for surgical patients. And that's huge for so many people. Okay, Dr. Brainin, as we talk about this, the big takeaway I'm seeing here is that you want patients to be more of an active participant in the process and in their recovery rather than just passively going through the trauma of surgery. You're asking patients to be part of the healthcare team in a way, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's about preparation. It's about expectations. And it's about changing the role. If we're the sick person in the bed, rather than we give you a job, which is ambulation, early intake of foods and liquids, you take an active role, and that's important. It's that fight that you have in you that we need
here's
at the table.
Here's an email from Stephanie in Avondale. Will these guidelines affect women laboring in hospitals? We're currently told women in labor should have nothing by mouth.
That is an exciting question that we are just broaching in our organization, working with our obstetrics leadership and department and clinicians. Looking at bringing these protocols and this research to our laboring patients.
So they could be thrown out.
Yes.
Because I vividly remember nothing but ice chips. And I have to tell you guys, that wasn't so great.
You know, it's the same dynamics. Dynamics. Limiting opioid use, more hydration, really bringing patients to a place where they can recover quicker and go home safer.
It's Baptist Health's ERAS, Enhanced Recovery After Surgery, a big change in the medical field. Josue Brainin, MD, is anesthesiologist at Baptist Health. Francine Maribel leads the task force on ERAS at Baptist Health. Thank you both so much for sharing this with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
In a moment, Cole Pepper, as he takes a look at one of the best players on the field for the Jaguars this year, what's happening to him. And also, don't miss it, a live in-studio performance from the Sandalwood High School Marching Band. Yep, they're going to play in studio, so keep listening. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back.
It's the 30th anniversary of an American tradition, the National Memorial Day Concert.
Join me, Joe Mantegna.
And me, Gary Sinise.
With Sam Elliott, Patti LaBelle, Alison Krauss, Dennis Haysbert, and General Colin Powell. It's a time to come together to honor and remember our troops, veterans, and our military families.
Thank you from the bottom of our hearts.
The National Memorial Day Concert.
Coming May 26th at 8 p.m. to WJCT Public Television.
Of Health North on Max Leggett Parkway is the region's newest hospital and outpatient medical center, featuring all private rooms, 12 labor and delivery suites, full imaging, surgical services, and 24-hour emergency care. More at north.ufhealthjax.org.
Cypress Village, a continuing care retirement community, features apartments and homes surrounded by lakes and walking trails, minutes from the beach and adjacent to Mayo Clinic. 901-4222. More at lifecare.brookdale.com.
In the 1980s, archaeologist James Dunbar helped to prove that people and mastodon coexisted in Florida nearly 15,000 years ago. Today, he's making similar discoveries at Wakulla Springs. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with James Dunbar. We'll discuss Florida ephemera and the Spanish mission system. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Squid are among the smartest and most interesting creatures in our oceans, and there's still much we don't know about them, like how they interpret colors.
Squid are able to match their background very well. They're able to camouflage really effectively, but they're colorblind.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Most self-help books focus on finding a path to a better you. The Second Mountain asks how a better you can make a better world. Columnist David Brooks talks about his new book on self-help and selflessness. Next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sports Wrap-Up with Cole Pepper is sponsored by Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether Restaurants.
Welcome back. Big questions about one of the Jaguars' best players, as Telvin Smith says he's not going to play this year.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Pepper has more about this. Hey, good morning.
Good morning. This is certainly a surprising development. You don't usually see this for a guy who's not trying to get a new contract. Mm-hmm. A little bit of background here first. Smith was a fifth-round pick out of Florida State, certainly has overachieved from his draft spot to become a Pro Bowl linebacker and one of the league's top tacklers. For the last several years, he's been the Jaguars' emotional leader on defense. And in mid-April, when the Jaguars began their offseason conditioning program, Smith, along with Jalen Ramsey, were no-shows. Yannick Ngakoue showed up for the first couple of days, then went on to work out on his own. Then in the week leading up to the draft, there were reports that the team had other teams had reached out to the Jaguars to inquire about the possibility of trading for Smith. Obviously, nothing came of those conversations. I should say as well that these kinds of conversations happen all the time. General managers want to have information and know if a player might be available, and if so, how much. Mm-hmm. They might take a flyer on him, see if the Jaguars would bite. Jaguars did not. Then Monday, this past Monday, Smith posted on Instagram a video where he seemed to be taking some of those trade rumors personally. Wanted to assure the fans that he was, in his words, do all till I die. So on Thursday, then he posted on Instagram again, this time a written post that said he was stepping aside from football for the year. And that Instagram post was the first time that Doug Marrone had heard that Smith was taking a year off and, in fact, has still not heard from the linebacker. So now what? Well, now the Jaguars are trying to find out why. We're all kind of trying to find out why that Smith would take a year away from football. The Jaguars are going to have to play with 11 guys on the field anyway on defense, so they're going to have to make some adjustments. They do have some options, including moving Miles Jack around to give them some flexibility, but this certainly did has to be categorized as an out-of-the-blue kind of decision for Telvin Smith, and one that I think has a lot of Jaguars staff
scratching their heads.
And fans scratching their heads.
Sure. Well, keep us posted. Meanwhile, the Jaguars just concluded rookie camp.
Yeah, and they'll have OTAs starting next week, the organized team activities. It'll be the first time that the team will be on the field together in total. We'll keep an eye on that to see if Yannick Ngakoue or Jalen Ramsey show up for that. Those are, as the workouts are, voluntary workouts in the offseason.
Always good to have you on the show. Watch Cole Pepper every night on Channel 4, our partner, the local station, and follow him on Twitter. Thanks, Cole.
Thanks, Melissa.
And we want to squeeze in something really cool right now at the end of the hour. The Sandalwood High School Marching Band is on a quest to win the Barry Manilow Music Project. This is a nationwide contest. If they win, they receive $100,000 in musical instruments. Keep in mind, music programs like the Sandalwood Marching Saints aren't funded by the school district. And they are the only band in North Florida going for this huge opportunity. Band director Stephen Panoff is here now, along with some of the band members. Stephen, how important is it to the band to win this? And why would this be such a big deal for Sandalwood?
Good morning, Melissa. This would be a huge deal for the kids at Sandalwood because, like you said, the support, we've grown rapidly. When I arrived at Sandalwood in 2015, we only had about 35 kids in band. Now we have 160 plus in band. We need instruments, and the instruments that we do have, some are over 30 years old. Others are very cheaply made because we can't afford to buy really good quality instruments.
And so you need people to vote you up in the by the way, who doesn't love Barry Manilow? I mean, come on, it's Barry Manilow. Right. I just saw that name and I burst out laughing. I'm like, this is so great. Go to sandalwoodband.com and learn more about this and vote for Sandalwood to win the Manilow Music Project. They're in third place right now. We need to get them into first place. Now, the band's here. What are they going to play?
They're just going to play some of their songs that they usually play at football games. But when you do go to the website, you'll click on another link that will take you to the Manilow Music Project.
And then vote for Sandalwood. Okay, right now, here we go. It's the Sandalwood High School Marching Saints. The band plays now. Go, guys. Close out the show, guys, and go to sandalwoodband.com, sandalwoodband.com, and vote. Click on the vote button, and then you'll have to click one more time to help the Sandalwood Marching Saints win $100,000 from the Barry Manilow Music Project. You can vote every day until Thursday, right?
That is Steven? Correct. Every day.
Okay. Vote them up, guys. This is Duval. Support them. They need this money. Let's keep arts and music going in our schools. Sandalwoodband.com. Cast your vote right now. Thanks for being here, everybody. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and we'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Enjoy the music.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.